What is the best way to know life?
What is life?
Reality.
Is the life now?
Yes.
What is it?
Reality.
What reality is it?
Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking.
So what life is now at this moment, just one moment, what is it?
Seeing.
Seeing now is life. Where's seeing yesterday?
Yes.
Where was the seeing yesterday? Yesterday there was seeing?
Yes.
And where was seeing yesterday?
Where is yesterday's seeing?
Like now, the seeing that arose yesterday, is that seeing now?
No.
Has it completely gone?
Yes.
And the seeing now, will it soon be completely gone, the past seeing?
Yes.
So how long does seeing last for when it arises? Does the seeing now last for a whole day or a whole year or just for a moment now?
A moment.
Just for a moment, very, very short, and then gone completely. Is that correct?
Correct.
So no doubt about life now.
Sorry.
No doubt about life now.
Do you have any doubt? Do you think what is life or... What shall I understand about life, or you understand what life is now?
Understand.
Right. And your question, what is the best way to know life? So what would be the best way to understand about life now?
Knowing the truth.
Knowing the truth and understanding more about different realities. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So this is Nana's second question coming up. And just for the audience, Nana just turned 12 last week.
If I'm not greedy, but there's a little bit of attachment, is it okay?
What do you mean by okay?
I'm not sure.
I think you mean because you know that it's not good to be greedy, but if there's just... some ordinary attachment, like when you like mangoes, is that attachment all right? Is that what you mean, I think?
Yes.
If the answer is no, it's not. What's that? Is it okay?
I don't know how to answer.
So... a little bit of attachment now, that like when we enjoy the mangoes or enjoy the breakfast, it's just very common and ordinary. But is that attachment a good, wholesome mental state, or is it a not good, wholesome mental state?
Not good.
Not good. Is it the same as when you're kind and help your daddy and friends, or is it different from when there is kindness?
Different.
And which one is kusala or wholesome?
Helping is kusala.
Helping is kusala. What about attachment? Is attachment kusala or akusala?
Akusala.
Akusala. So is it good to have more and more kusala or to have more and more akusala?
Kusala.
More kusala. So when it's a little bit of akusala, a little bit of attachment, we can say it's not a big problem like when you're very greedy, but the little bit of attachment leads to a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. So even though it's not a big problem like being greedy, still it's not kusala or wholesome. Is that correct?
Correct.
And do you like attachment?
No.
Really?
When you enjoy those mangoes, when there's attachment to the mangoes, do you enjoy that? Do you like that?
Enjoy the mango.
Do you dislike attachment?
Yes.
When?
I think usually when there is
attachment, like when we enjoy the mangoes, usually there is lots of pleasant feeling, isn't there? Not unpleasant feeling, there's pleasant feeling. So usually we like that attachment and like that pleasant feeling. Is that correct? We would like to have more pleasant feeling.
So now it's Kunsara's answer. Is that correct?
Correct.
Correct?
Yes.
Is what she said correct?
Yes.
Okay, third question.
What is the real reason that sometimes we get angry?
Anger is anger, not you. So the reality of, at the moment of angry, being angry, is the anger itself.
What's the real reason?
What's the question, please?
The real reason. The question is, why does anger arise? Why do sometimes we get angry? So it's not we get anger, it's anger arises. So her question is, why does anger arise?
There must be conditions for anything to arise. If not, then nothing arises. No matter anger or what, not only anger. Right?
Right.
And if there is no greedy attachment, will there be any anger?
Yes.
So sometimes there is anger but no attachment, is that right?
Right.
But usually it's because we would like to have something very nice and very good for ourselves, like we want people to say nice things to us, or we want to everything to be the way we would like it. And when it's not the way we would like it, when they don't say the things we would like to hear, for example, that's when we get angry.
Yes.
So actually we can see that it's because of attachment that there is anger or being a bit cross, even a little bit. So attachment to me, myself, is what leads to anger. Do you think that's correct?
Correct.
Anyone else want to say anything?
From an ordinary perspective, sometimes we just dislike something.
Right.
So loud noise or screechy music or something like that.
Screechy chairs.
Sound of screechy chairs, we just like it, can make us have slight irritation or anger if it's stronger. So from that point of view, one could say it doesn't seem to be connected with attachment. It's difficult to see the connection, right?
Right.
Okay, fourth question, then if anyone else has any more comments on any of the other ones, they can help.
Please say more about visible object.
More?
Yes.
Close your eyes. Is there any visible object appearing?
No.
Not at all?
Hearing.
No, I mean not at all visible object.
That which is seen. Is anything seen when you close your eyes?
Seeing.
Can seeing see anything when you close your eyes?
No.
Close your eyes again. Is there anything appearing?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Darkness?
A little bit of light, or completely
dark? Little bit light.
And that is visible object.
Okay.
Whenever there is seeing, there must be that which is seen. And we can use the word visible object, or what word it doesn't matter at all, because the characteristic of that which is seen is a reality.
Okay.
Because it's clear when we talk about hearing that it's just sound heard. It's not the voice and it's not the waterfall. And the same with seeing, when there is seeing, no matter the eyes are open or closed, it's just visible object that's seen. But immediately we think we see papers and tables and people, but actually it's just that which is visible, just like it's just sound which is heard. Is that clear?
Clear.
So where are you now? Where are you now?
She knows it's a trick question.
Know me.
Know me. So, what is there?
Reality.
What reality is there?
Yes.
What reality is there? What kind of reality is there?
Hearing.
Okay. Is the seeing at moment of hearing?
When there is hearing, is seeing at the same moment or a different moment?
Different.
At moment of seeing, is there hearing?
No.
Where are you?
Where are you?
Only reality.
Pardon?
There's only reality.
Nowhere. Right?
Yes.
Because actually there's no you. So there is no you at
yes.
all. At all.
Only thinking, right?
Right.
From today on, there's no you. From this moment on, there's no you, right?
Right.
So who's there?
Reality.
Uh-huh. What kind of reality?
Hearing.
And what else?
Seeing.
What else?
Touching.
What else? Touch.
Thinking.
What else?
What is heard?
Sound.
What is seen?
Visible object.
What is touched?
Heart.
Does anyone touch?
Only touching.
And what does touching touch?
Hardness.
And what is life at this moment?
Touching.
Touching. Yeah. So to understand life means just to... To understand life means just to understand reality now.
Yes.
That's very, very good, Nana. Anyone else have any questions for Nana or any answers to her questions?
I'd just like to clarify something that
Jonathan picked up on, that anger is conditioned to arise and attachment is a condition for anger, but is it always conditioned by anger, or sometimes can anger be conditioned by previous moments of anger or previous accumulation?
If there is no attachment to sense objects at all, then there cannot be any aversion at all. So without attachment to sense objects, like in the case of the anagami, no more aversion at all. So the accumulation of anger or annoyance or aversion or dosa is conditioned by ignorance and attachment in the past that leads to that aversion. No attachment, no aversion.
So when you say conditioned, what condition is it exactly? What type of condition?
Well, we can talk about the natural decisive support condition for aversion to arise, but we can talk also about how the condition of all arising is actually because of attachment in that sense, but actually it's because of clinging to an object and not getting what one wants that is the condition for that aversion to arise.
If I were to be asked what was the condition for anger to arise, my answer would probably be, well, previous accumulation of anger towards that particular object.
I would like to ask for your advice, Nana. I like this play very much. Is it good or not? What do you think about that? I like this place. Do you have any advices for me?
He likes this being here very much, so he has a lot of attachment or liking to be here. So he's asking you what you suggest. Is it good or not good that he has so much liking and attachment now? Do you think they should be a little bit more understanding about attachment? Okay. And what is the attachment to? Can we talk about the kind of realities there is attachment to? What kind of realities is there attachment to?
I don't know how to answer.
Like seeing now, is it attachment to seeing now? Attachment to hearing now? To different realities in life? Why don't you do what Ajahn does, and if you're not quite sure, you can just ask him a question in turn. You just say, what do you think? Why don't you say, what do you think?
What do you think?
He would say that, I think I like it.
You had a good answer. Because Ajahn gave you answers about you liking you liking the food, something like that, right? Greedy. So Ajahn already gave you the answer, so I just want to have your comments about the answer. If you like the comment, then maybe you can repeat it to me.
I think she would like to hear what you think about the comments.
Well, it's not good or bad. It's just beautiful, and I like it. It's happened. It's natural. I like it. So it's not about like it or dislike it. It's about it just happened this way. I have an accumulation to like this kind of thing.
I think what you're saying is that you don't feel there's any harm in that kind of liking, right? Because it's natural and normal, and everyone would appreciate nice surroundings rather than unpleasant surroundings.
But I think that it's so very, very hard to understand that attachment condition, dukkha, or suffering or dislike, because it has to be the understanding of reality right now. Until there can be the moment of understanding the subtle attachment that it's there. Otherwise, it's no way to understand that it's a cause of all dukkhas. Because dukkha in that sense means the arising and falling away right now. And only Panya, which understands that moment, can see that whether there is subtle attachment to that or not. So one can see that everything is conditioned, but there is also like attachment to that object, which will bring more and more arising and falling away, which is dukkha. So in the sense whether the attachment brings about dukkha, it has to be the panya which can understand that.
But quite highly developed panya.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of attachment, conditioning, aversion now, it seems quite apparent, even without much understanding, that there is wishing to have things a certain way. One wishes to have the temperature as one would like it, one wishes to have the flavour as tea as one likes it, like it, and when it's not as one likes it, instantly there is aversion because of that accumulation of aversion conditioned by that attachment.
So you have to find out what conditions such moment of attachment, attachment to I is there. Otherwise there's no anger.
No. So it's attachment to I, attachment to sense objects for me, which instantly conditions disliking or aversion when it's not how I would like it at this moment. So it all comes back to when there's a lot of thinking or concern for I, when it's not kindness for others, for example, then there are conditions for annoyance or anger to arise.
What do you mean by attachment to I here? Because Sotapanna and Sakadagami have no more wrong view, no more self view, so but still there's attachment.
The I by way of tanha or didi or mana.
Can I pick up on something else that was mentioned, and that's this idea of place, that we are in a certain place. You seem to suggesting that that's actually because of the idea of self. So it's somebody in a certain place, but if there is reality, there's no place. So is it an aspect of self, the fact that we have this idea that we're in a place?
What about the self, the clinging to other reality, like when there's the understanding of rupa, there are the self, the clinging to sanya, vedana, sankhara and vinyana.
At the moment of understanding reality,
the understanding is I. When there's no understanding of the vedana, sanya, sankhara and dhamma.
So I understand.
Tanajan, just in your response to Sukhin's question about Sotapanna having eradicated ditti, but there is still attachment. And you talked about you talked about tanha, mana, and ditti. Can you talk about each one of those in relationship to that answer? How tanha is different from mana, is different from ditti? That's what you seem to imply.
It has to be direct understanding at that moment, whether with attachment or with the mana or with the ditti. Because ditti does not arise all the time, and mana does not arise all the time, but ditti arises with tanha, and mana arises with tanha at different moment. So when there is no ditti, but there is still I with tanha, not with ditti, not wrong view.
And when you're saying tanha, you're obviously referring to lobha. Ajahn, is that correct?
Whenever there is attachment, it's not the idea of self, but there is attachment.
Tanha and lobha exactly the same.
No difference at all.
Can I give an example for consideration? One sees someone else behaving towards another person inappropriately, we'll say. There can be dosa when seeing that, even though the object is nothing to do with the person watching. It's not anyone one knows, it's just some person behaving inappropriately can condition anger. Why?
To attachment.
To what?
Attachment to the what's appearing or not.
I don't think so. No attachment there.
So, by way of anusya, there must be, but...
Yes.
I'm not sure quite the track you're going down there.
Well, I'm asking what would condition the dosa in that situation.
Well, ultimately...
Of the three.
Of tanha, manro, ditti.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. For an enlightened person, I'm kind of imagining that all three would be involved in some way, but you're saying they're not.
I mean, they couldn't arise all three at the same time, right? So
No, okay, all right. I just thought it involved. Okay, all right, let me think about it for a moment. Tanha, which is lopa, mana, which, yeah, and ditti. Well, I would, at an educated guess, I would probably say ditti.
I'm not saying, but my thought would be mana.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm curious. Go on, Jonathan. Why would you be inclined to say mana?
No, I would not do like that.
Sorry? Oh, I would not. I see what you're saying. Okay.
I would not. I do not approve of that. That's not what I would do.
Better.
I know better.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Concerning tanha, mana, ditya, for me, the best example is my habit of looking myself on the mirror in the morning. I have either tanha or mana, or not often, but once in a while I have a ditti saying that, oh no, it's real, it's not just phenomena, it's real. In that case, it's ditti. But I have mana, and tanha is quite usual. Yeah.
Earlier you were talking about tanha conditioning dukkha. Is it all kinds of tanha, even sense object, that conditions dukkha? Any kind of, any tanha?
Because dukkha here is the arising and falling away of all conditioned realities.
So this is actually very hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first level truth, right?
Yes.
Tanha is the origin of dukkha. Second, sorry.
No, why I ask is because if I were to choose one, I would say it's the attachment to being which conditions, you know, rebirth. But
attachment to becoming. You know.
To becoming, yeah, mm-hmm. To becoming. I'm saying what I'm thinking about the first noble truth being a condition, the second noble truth being a condition for the first noble truth is continual existence. Yeah. So that's why what came to my mind was that the attachment of all the kinds of attachment. This sounds, if I were to be able to understand, I can understand in the sense that there's attachment to being, hence continuum rebirth. And I don't understand.
Is your microphone on?
It is. And I have a hard time seeing the relation. Say between attachment to visible object as a condition for rebirth.
Thank you, Sikhan.
It's because of all kinds of ignorance and attachment that kusala and akusala is performed, which leads to rebirth, and any ignorance or attachment accumulates and leads to all kinds of karma, and all seeing and hearing is conditioned in that way. So without those roots and without the attachment and ignorance being accumulated now, there is no results, no rebirth. That's why only the arahat who has eradicated all attachment, all ignorance, has no more karma.
Yesterday we are talking about khanda, five khandas, and Sarah, you said that even a single rupa can be regarded as rupa khanda, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Why just a single rupa itself, why is it necessary to say that it's rupa khanda? It's just rupa. Why do we have to say it's rupa khanda? Can you see my point? It's a rupa. Then it's a rupa. Why do you have to say it's a rupa khanda? Khanda means an aggregate. Yeah? It's a bunch of rupas. Then we can say it's a rupa khandas. By just taking one rupa, why do you have to say it's rupa khanda?
It's like saying, why do we have to say each rupa is rupa dhatu, or each rupa is ayatana? Because whether we're talking about dhatus or khandas or ayatanas, we're talking about realities, not about concepts. And actually, a friend asked me about that this morning, and are saying that concept, even if there's clinging to concept, we cannot say that it's upadana khanda. Khanda is just reality. So a bunch of rupas, a bunch of anything, is not reality. Each rupa is reality. Each rupa is khanda. And what all rupas have in common is that each one is rupa khanda. Each one arises and falls away, and it is rupa khanda, no matter they are far or near, or in the past or in the future, or high or low, or this hardness or that hardness. Each one is rupa. Each one is rupa khanda.
Another way of considering that question is to ask why the Buddha classified dhammas in different ways, as dhatus, as ayatanas, as khandas, as four foundations of mindfulness. Many different ways are given in the teachings for consideration of dhammas, to explain different aspects of dhammas.
It's not difficult to understand what you're saying, yeah? But here my specific question is, yeah? If it's just rupa, it's just rupa. We need not say, it could be a dhatu or whatever, but we need not say it's rupa khanda. Khanda means a group, aggregate.
I think that's the issue, the meaning of khanda. What you understand khanda to mean is one thing. What Jonathan or Sarah understands khanda to mean is something else. So maybe
I'd like to have clarification on the notion of khanda. Why even a single khanda has to be called as a rupa khanda?
Could we say also, because
when rupa, there is the arising of rupa, arises within kalapa. We know there are at least eight. When there's visible object, there's nine, I believe. So we can perhaps say then that there is a group. Could we say that?
But what's the meaning of khanda? In
khanda,
Pali, what does it mean?
It means a group. Or like it means an aggregate khanda.
That which arises and falls away, that is past, future, and present.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the meaning of khanda, far and near?
Not far and near.
Yes.
Yeah.
In terms of Pali, this means like a khanda is just a group or a thing. Yeah.
But we read, for example, in the beginning of the Dhamma Sanghani about all the different kinds of khanda, and it refers to the, is it the nine types, far, near, past, future, present, and so on? All, each one is khanda. So any rupa, whatever kind, whenever it's arisen, each one is khanda because it arises and falls away.
Yeah.
Because you used to think of khanda as group, like sila khanda, samadhi khanda, and panya khanda. But actually, khanda itself means that which arises.
That which?
Arises and following, so it's present, past, and future, near and far, outside or inside.
Gross, subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's what is said in Sutta, Khanda Sutta. Yeah. But still, it's hard to understand. Well, I know that it's if it's a rupa, it's just rupa. If it's a sanya, then it's sanya. Why
so,
one single set. A single moment of sanya,
so
a single moment of rupa.
So is rupa ayatana?
Yeah.
Is rupa an ayatana?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, by different ways. Buddha taught the teachings by way of being khanda, or by way of being dhatu, or by way of being ariyasaccha or patichasamuppada.
But compared to other sort of classifications, here, khanda itself has the meaning of aggregates, And it gives me an impression that...
Because it arises and falls away in that sense. No matter it's beautiful one, it arises and falls away. So forget about one meaning, only one meaning of khanda, but think about the other meanings of khanda too.
I'm not sure if I get it right. When the Tao gets the idea about being a group,
yeah.
Is it in fact actually not you're thinking about five khandas as a group or something like that, right?
Yeah, group.
And that's not the meaning of khanda.
So, because then it's like
idea, but khanda refers to a reality. Each reality is a khanda. So we could say there are five kinds of realities. Each rupa is one kind of reality. Each Vedana is one kind of reality. Each Vedana has in common with every other Vedana that it is Vedana. Each one is Vedana Khanda.
And the idea of group comes from the fact that all rupas, past, present, near, far,
each one is rupa,
is
Khanda.
Of the same nature.
It's of the same, it's in the same.
So that group of rupa,
because,
group of...
Each of these rupas have a common characteristic, then it's possible to classify them as khanda.
They're all empty. Whether the rupas of the past, near, or all rise and fall away completely.
Without one, can there be group?
Why is one? One cannot be a group.
No.
That's my point.
Because you think of khanda as a group.
Yeah.
Right? But actually without a reality, can there be a group?
One reality?
So each
reality, one reality doesn't appear by itself. When something appears, all the other, say, the other and the other four khandas are required.
So can the one kind of rupa be a group? Like hardness, just only one, kalapa. Can that be a group? Because it is rupa khanda.
No, it's a group in the sense that the hardness itself doesn't appear. If something is experienced as hardness, the other four khandas has to be there.
So what do you mean by group?
So it's an object as well as subject.
Group of what?
Group of all these sanya, vedana,
so,
and sankara. And we
sanya is there because it arises and it falls away.
Yeah.
And it's different by way of far or near, inside or outside.
Yeah.
Each one is different.
Each one is different.
But they cannot be.
Each one is required to experience hardness as hardness. Hardness doesn't appear.
I think what Tadao is referring to is the idea as made that this is the five khanda plane, this is the four khanda plane. So in the five khanda plane, at any moment, there are these five.
By way of clinging. Upadana khanda. Otherwise, there are all khandas. One is a khanda. They are all khandas because each one is a khanda.
So, just moving on a bit, we cling also to concepts, which isn't khanda.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But without. Khandas, can there be clinging to concepts without seeing or visible object? Can there be clinging to the idea of a microphone or a table or a friend? So it's without realities, there's no thinking about concepts.
No, there's no concepts, but we cling, for example, to mathematics.
Clinging can cling to anything.
Okay.
But so there can be clinging to idea of table, but it's... It can be upadana, but not upadana khanda, because
okay.
It's not
so
khanda.
And concepts are not real, whereas the khandas are real. And as Sarah said, that it's because of khandas that there are concepts.
Mm-hmm.
But the clinging is a khanda.
Sorry?
The clinging at that moment is a khanda.
Yes, and the consciousness at that moment is khanda.
Well, what's the use of saying that clinging is a khanda? We can say just clinging is a clinging. It's one reality. That's enough. Why do you have to say clinging is a khanda? Rupa is
a
khanda.
If we are talking about the khandas, then, and what are khandas and what are not khandas, for example, that's the context. Yeah. Because Alan is saying, well, concept is not a khanda among the khandas.
But khanda has a specific classification. It's rupa khanda, vedana sanya, and sankara and vijnana. Mm-hmm. Why that kind of classification is required to describe rupa as just rupa?
So if we're talking about that clinging, so that clinging at that moment, it's a reality and it arises and falls away, and that's why it is khanda. The concept, which is maybe the object, it doesn't arise and fall away. It's not a reality, so it's not khanda. So khanda is just referring to any conditioned realities which arise and fall away.
I think that's why
it's khanda.
As an object of clinging.
I think Jonathan made a very...
Okay.
I think Jonathan made a very perceptive point, because I was overlooking that fact, that it's the clinging that's the problem. And that, of course, as you know, that's sankhara khanda. That is one of the chetasikas, lobha. So it's strictly true to say that it is a khanda. And I was overlooking that point that Jonathan made, that it's, even though it's thinking, it's still, it can be, obviously, it can be a lot of attachment involved to that kind of thinking. And I think that's easy to overlook if they're not thinking carefully, or understanding carefully, more appropriately.
I interpret khanda to mean that there are many different types of rupa, and we call them khanda. It's not just one rupa, that there's thousands of different types of rupa.
But
in fact,
each one is khanda.
Each one is khanda.
But
they belong
khanda
to that group, khanda.
Each rupa, each hardness is rupa khanda. So that is what they have in common. So when you say they belong to the group, well, each one is rupa khanda. Because as soon as one says belong to a group, then it's an idea, whereas khanda is reality.
Oh, I see. I see what you mean now.
Each rupa is a group of, part of rupa khanda. It's a sort of general sort of idea.
No, it's a general idea, but actually if one reads very carefully and considers carefully, and one knows that khanda has to be reality, then one understands what's meant by each rupa, gross, subtle, near, far, past, future, present. Each one is khanda itself.
So, by using...
Each one arises and falls away, whereas the collection...
It's an idea. So using this word khanda is to push us towards the reality and not the idea of some group which is just an intellectual.
The Buddha talked about khandas is to understand realities, not to understand concepts or ideas.
Yeah.
The same with ayatanas, the same with dhatus.
I don't know if it helps, but my own experience, I find when I first came, even now, I found the distinction as nama and rupa, chitta chetasika, rupa, as the most easily understandable. And whenever I heard about khanda, I found it very difficult to understand. But of course, I found it difficult because I would sometimes think, like you, that it's a group or something, but at the same time I also understand that it's not that. It's actually referring to reality, nadamas and rupas, but with a different understanding, which as of now I don't have. So I don't know. I don't know if trying to explain will help, but I know that it's something that Pandya would know.
No, say, Sarah, if you like to say, rupa is rupa karma. Now, as I say again, why do we say rupa is rupa? And why is it necessary just to see rupa as a rupa? Yeah? Why is it necessary to attach a notion of the body that comes as a transparent rupa, whether it's sanya, sankara, vinyana? Why this classification has to do with when you see rupa as a rupa? It's not.
I think all these different classifications, as you call them, Tadal, as Sarah and Kunina and Ajahn's always reminding us, they represent reality. You know, we can talk about, depends how fine you want to go, really, because we know that there are concepts that talk about realities. There are many, there are just millions of different types of concepts. But ultimately, and some of them are enumerated, like the Vijñāna Paññāti or the Avijñāna Paññāti, or the, you know, the realities which talk about unrealities and so on. But they're continually reminding us about reality. They're pointing to reality. So when you ask, why is it necessary? Well, it's probably not necessary, you might say, to some people. It might not be necessary. But they can be very helpful to pointing to what appears now, and that's what I know I'm inclined to forget. I mean, I find this all really interesting to a point, but I know Kunin is always trying to remind us and me that it points to reality that arises right now, and if we're forgetful about that, then we can go down other tracks which may not be perhaps so helpful at times.
Do you see a difference, for example, a difference in the understanding between simply saying that visible object or I is rupa and that it is an ayatana? It shows different aspects of the reality, right? Yeah. So same with khanda.
I can see that.
Same with khanda.
But it's an individual element, in a sense, individual.
You know, what I find helpful too is to remember that, like, for example, it may be clear, at least in theory, that hardness touched now is impermanent, visible object now is impermanent. But what about the hardness or the visible object experienced in the deva realm, or what about the one last life or next life? So it's pointing out that whatever rupa it is, no matter here or there or past or future or gross or subtle, each one is impermanent.
Kuntadao, is there any past reality?
Realities which has passed, which must have been, or no doubt.
So you know that one has gone.
Yeah, gone.
And the present one is not the past one.
Yeah.
But it arises and falls away.
Yes.
It will be the past again.
Yes.
So this is the meaning of khanda. That which arises and falls away. So what passed? What has passed? Please, what?
All the experiences.
Not all. Just one at a time.
Just say
you may say rupa or vedana or sanya or sankhara. Yeah. But you see that each one is a khanda.
Perhaps it's like this. I'm not sure. When we talk about rupa, we have yet to understand, we have to understand more about it. We can understand the characteristics, and it has its particular characteristics and its general characteristics. We know that, right? So we understand it more and more. Now, as the understanding develops, that it sees that it rises and falls away, then we can it conditions an overall understanding and confidence that it must be the same with all the rupas in the past and in the future. It must be like this. So that is another level of understanding, is it not? So that's where the concept of khanda, as against just saying it's rupa.
I understand. Because you're saying that even though it's a single rupa can be called rupa khandas, because sort of rupas which have sort of the same characteristic, all the rupas have the same characteristics, so it's possible to group them as rupa khandas, but when we say rupa khanda, it means specifically, single rupa.
See, visible object.
Groupable.
Visible object is not the same as sound. Different characteristic, different particular characteristic, but they're the same in the sense that they're rupa. They're the same in the sense that they rise and fall away, and they're same as in this in the sense that they are conditioned.
He's got it.
Because it's groupable, but when we say rupa khanda, we specifically mean a single rupa.
And forget about the group.
No.
The word group. Just forget it. Just forget it. Is there any rupa?
Yeah, okay.
One characteristic?
It can be called as rupa khanda. Because all the rupas have the same characteristic.
I have a question on elements. When the Buddha teaches about elements, what aspect of Dhamma that he wants to point out? And if we compare with khandas, what is the difference?
Can we say that all Dhammas are tattu?
Yes.
So in order to understand them more and better, shall we classify them into different ones? Like seeing is chakudhatu, chakuvinyana, and that which appears now is rupadhatu. See, just by way of classifying differently so that we can understand better and better by way of khanda, by way of dhatu, but they are all realities, different ones.
The 18 dhatus.
In order to understand why and how we could make it like group, classified as group. But it does mean that all are group, but each one is under that group. Like rupa cannot be nama. So rupakhanda includes all kinds of rupa, and namakhandas includes all kinds of nama. And by way of tattu, how many are of them in order to understand better and better that they are not self.
In the case of comparison between dhatu and khanda, we know that nibbana is a dhatu, but not khanda.
Okay.
So when we're talking about khandas, it's really stressing the realities which are permanent, that don't last even deva realm or in the past or in the future. But when we're talking about dhatus, it's really stressing the
Non-self,
the anattaness of each reality, even nibbana, any reality, is just an element, not belonging to me or anyone else, just an element, that's all.
For me, the term element stresses the impersonal nature of dhammas. And just going back to Dadal's original question, we say rupa khanda when we're talking about khandas. If we were talking in terms of citta cetasika rupa nibbana, we might say rupa dhamma or nama dhamma. It just depends whether we're talking about khandas or dhatus or ayatanas or what. Every time we refer to rupa, we don't have to call it rupa khanda.
So, Jan, like you often need to remind us, understand each word. This discussion actually reminds us not to just use words without understanding.
And Nina, you had a little accident this morning, and I'm sure you're not
last night,
I'm sure you're not feeling very well. Anything you would like to hear about, or anything you've been considering that helps you? About karma and how it can bring its result any time, and the real problems in life, or anything you'd like
I feel sorry for myself and my painful feeling, and that I feel so sleepy now because I had so many needles in for 1 hour, and it affects me, so I think of myself. So it's good to be reminded of that.
And this morning we had a little chat earlier before Helen and Ian left, and we were talking a little bit about how all the, Ajahn was talking about how all the disturbances or problems in life are actually because of thinking of oneself at this moment. So we think of disturbances or problems because of the weather or because of accident or the people around us or some difficulties. But actually it's just because of clinging to oneself at this moment that one is disturbed.
And thinking of the future, because I mentioned to Vincent, we go for luncheon and I can't take the golf car. So Vincent said, but it's not yet, it's the future. It's not my heart, you reminded me.
And Nina, I was just thinking that that in a way you're very inspiring. You like to talk about your own akusala. And that's okay, because it's arisen already, right? And the goal of studying is to understand whatever
to
has
understand,
arisen.
Yeah.
So no problem.
We shouldn't mind what
shouldn't
arises.
Mind, yeah.
That's what we learn all the time, and Jonathan is also reminding us all the time. We shouldn't mind.
And Tiny Tam, any other reminders from the chat this morning that you found helpful when Ajahn was talking about just life at this moment and any difficulties or anything?
I felt that even though we just went, Ian went, came to say goodbye, and Ajahn give you a short talk with him. But even though I find it's very useful, it's not only for Ian or for Hena to went to say goodbye, but it's just for everyone, just at any time. It's because I think it's not the problem or the issue of a person. It's just the reminder is for everyone. It's always all the time about realities, about now. But because when you think it's personally, it's the problem, my problem, or problem with friends or family. But it's, if you come back to the realities, it's just a dharma, it's just condition. And it's problem because no understanding at that moment.
And that was, that was the point that was stressed, that the only a problem because of not enough understanding, and as understanding grows, then less and less problems. Anything else?
And it's only the Dhamma and conditioned Dhamma, and we cannot do anything.
Yeah. But the thing is, even this is because of not understanding, but what can you do?
So when there's the idea of what can I do, that is not understanding. So when it's understanding, one knows that life has to be like that, like moments of discomfort and moments of attachment and moments of sadness, pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, but each one is Dhamma, each one is Kanda, arises, it falls away, it doesn't last for an instant. Not anyone who can do anything. And when we think I can find the solution by doing this or that, it's not understanding what is conditioned already at this moment.
And you say, what can one do, meaning, as Sarah was just saying, there's nothing one can do, but at least one does not have the idea that there is something to be done, and therefore one makes it worse by accumulating more attachment and ignorance and wrong view, which only makes the problem worse in the future. So at least by knowing that there is nothing that can be done at that moment, one is avoiding making the problem worse.
So there are two different kinds of what one can do. One is with attachment and looking for a way to do something, and one with understanding that everything is anatta.
Yes, I also had the opportunity to appreciate really the kindness of my friends here who came around the corner and looking at me when I had all those needles in. It was very nice.
Sukhin, I also find it's like very thin, the borderline between like one can do something with understanding or doing nothing. It's just like somehow you understand, oh, you cannot do anything to change the situation, but it's, sometimes it feels like, oh, you just let it go or ignoring it.
The idea of letting go is not something you just think about when you're confronted with a situation and you're anticipating things going to happen but nothing can be done. It's letting go means it pertains to the reality of the moment. It means that the Dhamma has already arisen by conditions, no self to do anything, and we don't know what's going to come next, right? So sometimes the letting go that people have, the idea of letting go, is actually attachment. And, fear of what might happen and, wanting things to be different and then cannot do and then say, okay, let go. But that's not the letting go.
So understanding at this moment, as we said yesterday, means detachment from what has arisen now at that instant. It doesn't mean that one's daily life is any different. It doesn't mean that one doesn't go to have lunch or one doesn't pick up the microphone or this or that. The actual reality is each one is kanda, each one arises and falls away, each one is conditioned, no one there. So if one thinks that the solution will be to go turn left and not turn right, this is just a conventional way of thinking. But actually, even at that moment of turning left, there are different realities arising by conditions, not by self who does anything. It's just an idea at that moment. So life carries on as normal. It doesn't mean we don't travel, we don't do this or that, but we understand these are just ideas. But the realities, the seeing, the hearing, the thinking at each moment, each one is conditioned. No one there, no one who does anything. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It always makes sense, but it's not ever happen all the time.
So it's just the making sense or the understanding is just for a moment. So at that moment, no problem, no difficulty, because it's clear at that moment, even if it's just intellectually, that no one is there. And next moment, there is attachment and ignorance as usual. But the understanding that arises now accumulates. So that's why the listening and considering is so important, because usually in a day, it's just attachment and ignorance accumulating as usual. But through hearing, through considering, through understanding, understanding begins to accumulate so that there's more and more understanding in life instead of just attachment as usual. And no expectation. If one thinks there should be more understanding and there should be less clinging or less unhappiness or less this, then that's the problem, is the expectation instead of just accepting and understanding how it is. Like Nina said, okay, she feels tired and sorry for herself. Just very natural, just conditioned dharmas. Otherwise, one always has the idea, it should be like this, or I should be happier, or I should have more understanding. But that's just more clinging, expecting it to be that way. And this is what is meant by understanding accumulation, understanding one's accumulation at this very moment.
But we can help expecting. Yeah, I mean, we cannot help expecting.
No, but it's actually just clinging at that moment. Actually, it's not I who am expecting. It's just moments of clinging, and that clinging and expecting doesn't last at all. But that's what I meant earlier. One can see how that clinging and expecting brings sorrow or grief when it's not the way we would like it to be.
If Kwanya has been accumulated, you cannot help understanding expectation.
Do the Taiwanese have any more questions about parallels and meditations and breath and any... otherwise we have a smoking question here.
No question. Just wondering if anyone have any suggestion that to have quit that, then it could be nice to share with me.
Share my experience. I quit smoking. I smoked for about 20 years. And I was practicing yoga pranayama. It's actually replaced because we smoke because we feel it's good, right? And then when I practice pranayama with all the fresh oxygen into the lung, you know, only a few minutes a day or morning and afternoon, you practice a few minutes. And that become something, become a new attachment because fresh air is feeling better than a cigarette. That's how I actually got rid of smoking, because now something even better than smoking cigarette.
No,
the fresh air is better.
I don't think it's a rule.
Just before you go, I just want to mention the laughter that will come across on the tape, because Sarah just put in front of Ty a box of cough lollies, and this is supposed to be a substitute for a packet of cigarettes. So he's to keep that in his pocket. And whenever he feels like a cigarette, he can grab that packet and have a cough sweet.
But then he will be addicted to the cough. To the cough. Like a John and I.
John, I remember when another friend had quite a smoking problem, and we had we had tried to help him, and you said something to him which he found very helpful, and even though he was a chain smoker, he immediately and completely gave up smoking. And I think you talked to him about the danger of addiction, but I forget exactly what you said, so I don't know if there's...
I couldn't remember.
No, I couldn't.
Food. There was a discussion on one of the tapes about when we have a plate of dinner, that there's lots of different types of food on the plate, and that this is an aspect of dukkha, but it's not the dukkha in the sense of the unpleasant feeling or reality. It's dukkha in the sense of we're always moving on to something else, even though it's pleasant. Is that right? So there are three types of dukkha. So I think it's the middle type of dukkha. First type of dukkha is the unpleasant, intrinsically unpleasant feeling, and the absolute dukkha is the arising and falling away. And this middle dukkha, which is it dukkha dukkha?
Viparinama dukkha.
Viparinama, yes.
So, referring to the pleasant feeling.
So how does that relate to the food on the plate then?
Maybe because even pleasant feeling, like one has a taste of this and this pleasant feeling, but that pleasant feeling doesn't last, and then one has another taste and another taste, and one's always looking for pleasant feeling, but actually each pleasant feeling doesn't last at all. So each pleasant feeling is also dukkha.
So even it's pleasant, it's
even
it's
pleasant, it doesn't satisfy. So when you've had a bit of meat, then you want a bit of vegetable to complement mm-hmm. one. You want yeah. something else as well, even though the first one is pleasant.
Yeah, I see.
And now it's time for lunch. I don't mean literally, but it's time for lunch. And you know that, oh, it's going to happen again, that I would want to come back to this, because there'll be a time when you're hungry. You need to eat.
So the first kind of dukkha, which everyone knows often in short, is given as unpleasant feelings. So when there's painful bodily feeling, or when there's dosa, an unpleasant mental feeling, that is unsatisfactory. That's dukkha. That's dukkha mm-hmm. dukkha. Everyone knows about that. And the next kind is a little more subtle, that even pleasant feeling, viparinama dukkha, is dukkha because that pleasant feeling never satisfies and
doesn't last. Mm. And then the third kind of dukkha, which the Buddha taught about when he was teaching about the Four Noble Truths, is sankhara dukkha, and it, in short, neutral feeling and all other conditioned realities are sankhara dukkha. So in brief, the five khandhas are dukkha, are sankhara dukkha, because each one arises and falls away. Each one is khanda, each one can be the object of clinging. So each one is sankhara dukkha, each one is conditioned reality, and each conditioned reality is dukkha, because it's impermanent and can be the object of clinging.
So when the Buddha taught in the sutta, I think if there was a mountain of gold and you had a mountain of gold, you'd still want something else. That's kind of looking at that aspect of dukkha in the sense that it's never satiated.
The right, or with the pleasant feeling, always wanting more and looking for more. So understanding about pleasant feeling as dukkha is not, doesn't have to be the understanding of it as a conditioned reality, but when it's sankhara dukkha, as in the Four Noble Truths, there has to be the understanding of reality of khanda, which is
so
impermanent.
What did you call it? A viparana dukkha?
Viparinama.
Viparinama dukkha. So when I look in my house and there's 33 cushions, I counted the number of cushions, that's an aspect of attachment to the non. It's just not having 10 cushions is not enough, so we have to have 32. And the reason I counted was because I wanted more cameras. So I thought I'd justify that by counting the number of cushions we have. But so that's actually, that aspect of dukkha is very much in daily life, isn't it?
Yes.
Almost every day, that aspect of dukkha is arising in daily life.
Is that enough?
Never.
One more.
Oh, one more. I want
or
another camera.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always something else.
Looking for
some pleasant feeling, yeah.
Never satisfied.
No.
Never understanding that the problem is now, the clinging now, the expectation now, the thinking now. Never satisfied, never content with reality that is conditioned at this moment.
Everything's on fire, like Sarah used to be like to fear that the desire is being sated.
That it's never, that desire is never sated. It's always wanting something more. It's like a fire. The more you throw on the fire, the more it'll burn. It just keeps on going. So he related that to the very famous Kassapa brothers, who were fire masters in their own way. And he said, everything's on fire. Everything's on fire.
So that understanding actually brings us to the present reality, doesn't it? Or can do. Because it's, unless we have to realise that it's at this moment, that fire.
Totally. Right. We're mostly in what Sarah has just reminded us of. We're always, we need to be reminded of the present moment because of ignorance, as Ajahn would say. It's always covering up. And we're always, because of attachment and lopa, all those three types of dukkha are always kind of lurking or obvious or not so obvious, but they're always there. But the last one, as Sarah alluded to, sankhara dukkha, which is what the first noble truth is all about, is what's the important one, and what you've just said then. That needs to be remembered, otherwise ignorance will take over again and again and again, as it does.
But most of the time, we don't know. I mean, our heads is on fire, but we don't even know it.
So are the Taiwanese ready with their questions?
Now, it's possible to go back to meditation center, but not for the purpose to have the correct understanding of what Buddha's teaching, but more for some physical benefit. that's what she is thinking now.
And what's the benefit?
It can be some physical benefit.
Physical benefit.
Right, right.
Can the same physical benefit be obtained without going to the meditation center?
We hear this same question from many friends when we're in Vietnam as well. Many of the ladies who are dressed as nuns, or many people, when they understand more about realities, they also ask, can they just go back to the temple, the pagoda, because there are other benefits and they have their friends there. But the danger for lay people of spending a time in the temple is that one is surrounded or associated by people who are following wrong practices, and one is hearing wrong view. So the danger is that if one's understanding is really not firm enough, if instead of hearing more about realities and more about right view, one is actually hearing more about wrong views and wrong practices, and one is expected, if one is in that environment, to chant or to sit quietly or to follow certain practices, then it's very easy to be swayed or to follow the wrong practice again, even if there are some health benefits like good food or something like this.
And also I think, given that those meditation centers are open to expecting that people will believe what they believe, follow what they follow. If you're going there not believing in what they do, without not following the instructions, then it sounds insincere, right?
It's kind of like an alcoholic going to a hotel to see his friends. It would be difficult to avoid other factors happening.
I think it's not a question of whether one goes to a meditation center or not, but whether one is true to oneself about one's attachments and views. Knowing that there is the inclination to do this, or knowing there is some wrong view, is more important than whether one goes here or there.
Is a meditation center, because the entire world is pushing us in the wrong way. So the world is pushing us towards having attachment. So it's not, we can't avoid the world, but we can recognize when it's pushing us away or pushing us not away. But of course, if we go to a meditation center, there'll be a reason for us to go there. But we should recognize that we can't choose whether we are in a certain situation or not. Often we are there by conditions, and it's a question of recognizing wrong view as wrong view, because actually wrong view is so much around us in every day life.
Yeah, we're exposed to wrong view.
We're all exposed to wrong view all the time.
Wherever we are.
Yeah.
So it's not a matter of avoiding the exposure, but the more understanding develops in daily life, the firmer that understanding is, the less inclination one would have, like Sundara's example, as an alcoholic, the less inclination there would be to be in that environment surrounded by other alcoholics, or the less inclination one would have to go to the temple to sit with one's eyes closed where other people are following a practice. So it doesn't mean that there aren't wrong views around, but one would not be inclined to go there to spend one's vocation on a retreat in that environment anymore, because many of us have had that experience.
And even for physical benefits, we're not sure that, you know, it will end up that way. We don't know, you know, sometimes people go for meditation and it's true that their health gets better or some disease are cured. But we don't know exactly what is the reason for that to happen. Because I have a lot of friends who are meditators, or I know teachers in meditation, and many of them, after years and years of practice, now they have also physical problems as well. So when we go to meditation centers where there are extreme practices, I think there might be even some dangers for health.
It's like some people say, wine is good for you, so drink.
And I was just thinking in relationship to Ellen's comment there that when we talk about the world, the Buddha talked about the world in the way of the six worlds of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and that is the world which we're inclined to forget. We're inclined to be seduced, I know I am, by what we conventionally refer to as the world. But you know, there's some really good suttas that are very, and Nina mentions those about what is the world really.
Also, we know there's a lot of wrong view. But here we're particularly concerned about the wrong view that misinterprets the Buddha's teachings. Meditation as taught in the name of Buddhism. So that's the immediate concern, because that's the real enemy. I mean, none of us who have any inclination to, if there's any inclination to meditate, would go to a Hindu meditation center. I mean, we would, for some reason, go to a Buddhist meditation center, right?
So Ellen did
bring me back to the issue that you tell me that in the school in England they touch about mindfulness, even though it's not mindfulness in the Buddhism sense, but also it's feel like something's lead to ditti. Can you tell more about that? Because I think it's very interesting to discuss.
Mindfulness is very fashionable. And it's coming into schools. There are organisations bringing it into schools, and it's wrong practice as we understand it, or as I understand it. But it's coming into primary schools, so it's being taught to 7-year-olds. It's coming into secondary schools, that's 11 to 18, and it's coming into universities. And it's so much of it, and because I am in education, and I'm wondering what I can do to write something or to challenge this practice of mindfulness. Because although it's calling itself secular mindfulness, which means non-religious mindfulness, nevertheless, the word mindfulness is acknowledged to come from Buddhism, but it's very different and harmful, I think, too. So it's a question of what or how to challenge. I think it should be challenged that this, or people should, or pupils should be able to be given the opportunity to consider what is right. So that's my issue in working within education, that this is coming into schools and it should be challenged. Because this idea that The central idea is that you don't need to join a religion to practice meditation. But in actual fact, we need to listen a lot to the Buddha's teachings, and we need to understand a lot to be able to develop mindfulness correctly. So I think there are several aspects of harm. Firstly, I think that it won't do any good. At all, I think it's, and that you're not, if you're not developing the right practice, you're developing a practice which is going in the opposite direction, and also I think that it must lead to the disappearance of the teachings. But I don't know how to challenge it within schools, because actually that the understanding that I have is so rare that it's difficult to make a kind of a statement against that.
Can you tell in details, like, what is the way to practice there? in order to be mindful, like you have to do a thing in certain ways, or you just concentrate on what you are doing. And
what she's asking is what the actual practice is, the mindfulness.
Oh, what the actual practice is. I think it's mostly doing something. It's mindfulness of breathing or the idea of self trying to do something. So it doesn't lead to detachment from the idea of self. There's no understanding of Abhidharma, no understanding of the difference between reality and concept. So it's vague. And
focusing on breath,
that's a standard one.
The aim,
I think, is to sort of still the thoughts of the mind to become more calm. So the aim isn't to understand reality as it is.
What's the mindfulness aspect that they teach?
Well, it's
because being calm isn't the same as mindfulness, so...
The mindful aspect is a piece is paying attention to the present moment in terms of thoughts, feelings, sensations, but it's with the idea of self. So it's.
I think you know, if I mean you're in this, it's something that's very close to your field of work. So, I mean, I would not bother because it's nothing to do with my concern about the Buddhism being what's taken for Dharma is not Dharma and polluting that and corrupting that. I would say that it's only a matter of making it clear that it's not Buddhism. You can do what you like, but it's not what the Buddha taught. So maybe if you don't like the word mindfulness, use something else, suggest something else. But I don't think that's the real danger of Buddhism. The real danger are the meditation centers.
Yes, I mean, the real danger is if you're calling it Buddhism and then it's not Buddhism, that's probably more of a danger than practicing the mindfulness. But on the other hand, there is the idea that mindfulness, it's as if it's taken from Buddhism and it still works. Well, it won't work.
It's just the same problem or issue all over the world, following different meditation practices, and people teach what they think is useful and helpful. And as we know, what's important is developing understanding, and no matter what we do or how we share, it's the understanding now that's most precious. And then one shares as one can.
To link it to some of the things that have been discussed over the past few days, there's a big danger in doing any practice which seems to bring a result, have some effect, beneficial, physical, mental, or whatever, emotional, because one then tends to assume that doing more of the same will bring more benefits, and one is attached to a method, instead of the appreciation we have is that the real problem in life is the dukkha we talked about earlier, the rise and fall, and this can only be overcome by development of understanding. And that is taking a view that is far, far longer than most people are prepared to contemplate.
So if you were in my position, you are in the educational sector, and as part of your responsibility, you have to write an article for the educational sector. You could choose to write about geography or history as part of that subject knowledge, or you could choose to write about something to do with Buddhism, which is of the highest value. So I think the first thing is that if you have a choice, you will then choose to write what is of the highest value to people, not what is of value, but not the highest value.
Well, I don't think you have to rationalize it too much. If you want to write about Buddhism, you do. The only thing I would caution against is the danger of having to bend Buddhism so much to fit other people's limited knowledge of the subject matter, that it...
So what would you write about?
In that situation, well, it would depend, I can't say, but I wouldn't have to be Buddhism, it could be anything.
Sorry?
what is awareness in Buddhism?
Yeah, you could write about that.
It's just like the questions here or the questions on our discussion list all the time. What is vipassana? What is awareness? What is insight? Because these kind of practices, like this one, it's stemmed from what people call vipassana meditation, and the practice starting with the breath and then whatever of the four satipatthanas. So it's all the wrong understanding about realities and what awareness is from the beginning. So if someone asks or one is commenting, one can talk about, as we do here, what awareness is, what realities, what it means to talk about realities as anatta, and how actually at this moment no one can control anything, and how focusing on breath has nothing to do with calmness or understanding at this moment.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the point that you write, that this idea of the difference between reality and concept is critical and can be understood fairly quickly. I think that you can begin to get a snip of understanding of that and to be able to see that mindfulness concerns this understanding of reality. So therefore I think that's useful, especially coming from a physicist, because the physicist, that's kind of what they do. So I think that pinpoints it. So it's not about the practice of mindfulness, but it's about showing that intellectually that there's this difference between reality and concept, and this is the beginning.
I think that even for mundane purposes, I don't think it works, because the way the Dhamma is explained is also it's in any subject.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
Because of accumulations, like when they try to do practice mindfulness, it's actually just concentration, right?
Yes.
And concentration is just a mental, universal mental factor.
Mm-hmm.
So what works is not, it's the accumulations of different skills and knowledge, not the concentration in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe that it works even for mundane purposes.
Yes, you might be right there, yeah.
What I'm picking up from Alan is that he can provide information, if you like, to enable people to think a little bit differently to what they may be hearing or have heard. If sometimes people with these different type of practices.
Does anyone have any Dhamma questions to come back to this moment or to ask a Jan? Because otherwise one can think and think and think about what shall I do and how shall I help in the future, and one forgets about reality at this very moment.
So it's reminding me about the elephant stuck in the mud trying to pull another elephant out. So little understanding. We don't see that the urgency is to develop understanding of realities now and just keep on just thinking of other things.
Can we talk about the truth just one word at a time?
Yesterday I was reading the Chanki Sutta in the middle length saying. And there's one extract. I would like to hear your comment on this. Okay. So, maybe you can read better.
Which one? So, Bharat Manja, it seems that among the Brahmins, there is not even a single Brahmin who says thus, I know this, I see this. Only this is true, anything else is wrong. And among the Brahmins, there is not even a single teacher or a single teacher's teacher back to the seventh generation of teachers who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong.
And the ancient Brahman seers, the creator of the hymns, the composers of the hymns, even those ancient Brahman seers, did not say thus, we know this, we see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. Suppose there were a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. So too, Bhavadaja, in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, the last one does not see. So what do you think, Bhavadaja? That being so, does not the faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? Is that it?
Can we say just like now?
I hope not. I hope they're not all totally blind.
Well, I'm thinking maybe the one in front is not blind, but the two behind are blind.
If there is no perfect or right understanding very firmly, can we say that it's not yet the understanding of reality now?
And the present situation is different because we have the teaching, the Buddha's teaching, whereas obviously those people did not.
So it must refer to the kinds of teaching of the teachers who don't have direct realization of the truth, right?
Yes, who, so they just and no access on to the word of anyone who does have direct mm-hmm. realization of the truth.
Okay.
Which is not the just situation today.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As I would see it.
Mm-hmm. It was what I was thinking too, but I wanted to hear from you. Sure.
So what is meant by Panyachakku?
Panyachakku. Does it refer to the first Sotapanna Maha?
The understanding of reality as it is right now. So many blind people, they need to be cured, and those who can find the right doctor to cure their blindness, then it's possible. So the teachings or the words of the Buddha help one not to be blind, little by little.
So the test is, because we're all blind before hearing the Dhamma, so we just try to find people leading us. The test is, when we finally meet someone, and then little bit we start seeing, that is the right teacher.
Until one is not blind. Because right understanding can understand whatever is taught right now. Like seeing is a reality, we can talk about that. But is that your blindness? Not really understand the moment when it arises and falls away. But as one can hear the teachings, one is not as blind as those who cannot find the right words at all. It seems like there is a medicine to cure, but have we had it already, or just begin to develop it, to take it little by little?
Is the Chakku Pasada located in the middle of the eyes? Chakku Pasada.
Yes.
Is it located in the middle of the eyes?
Yes, but who knows? But it's there for sure.
Because lately in Vietnam we had a discussion, and during the discussion some people brought up the case of some kind of yoga practitioners. And in that yoga practice, they train some blind people with some yoga techniques. And then at some point, they start to see. It's not like as clear as for ordinary people, but it is said that they can see.
Or imagine that it's seen. Something is seen.
Mm-hmm.
Not the seeing.
I have no direct account of that, just the story someone brought up.
Can someone who is born blind, can he imagine? What is seen?
Just thinking.
He will think in terms of sound.
Something there which is not known.
But never shape and form as in seeing.
And in that case that you mentioned, even if that person who during their life hasn't been able to see, because we don't know if someone is born from the first moment or maybe from during birth or something which is different, so the conditions to see again, it can be by conditions too.
So the rupa which is conditioned by karma can arise later, even though it's not from the first stage of life?
If it's at the first stage of life, if there is no seeing, no eye sense from the very beginning, it cannot arise later. But we don't know. If someone is blind, we have no way of knowing whether it was from the first moment or later, you know, when they were born, for example.
And I think the point is, if it's someone who was not born blind, but becomes blind later, and now because of this particular practice, he is able to see, whether it is really seeing or just imagining.
But if that person can just go by himself everywhere, like us, where we can see the obstacles, we can avoid the obstacles, for example?
You'd have to ask the person whether they are seeing through the eye or able to gauge objects by some other means without, you know.
The description that I was given is that they were able to see not through these physical eyes, but like some kind of, they call the third eyes, the third eye.
So it's like the electronic eye that we were discussing the other day. It's through another sense door. But this is all speculation. Similarly, with hearing, people can hear by having receptors implanted into their skull bones. But it's not ear door hearing, as far as I know.
Can you hear in a dream?
Sure.
Is it hearing?
No, at that moment.
Attempting to ask, can you hear in a dream? You can't.
In a dream,
someone
you just
calls
imagine.
You out.
But you dream about some words is
yes,
told.
Yes, but there's no hearing. Mm-hmm. It's just thinking.
But it's just like hearing.
Oh, it's just like.
I have a question, Ajahn, on passa.
Sometimes we say it depends on passa, contact, as to which citta arises to experience which object, such as visible objects or sound, pleasant or unpleasant object. And what I also heard you just mention on a tape that what selects passa to contact each object, it depends on citta, kusala, kusala, vipaka, or kriya citta. So can we say that these two seemingly different statements are just pointing to how citta and the chetasikas condition each other, that passa is needed for the citta to experience the
object. At moment of seeing.
See?
Yeah.
At moment
is there.
At moment of seeing depends on what passa has, what object has been contacted by passa, and for that passa to arise, there must be the seeing to experience
the
it.
The vipaka. The karma as conditions.
I'll also get in a quick question, if I may, about buddhanusati. We know when we talk about dhammanusati, reflection on dhammas, reflections on realities, actually this is the same as pariyatti, because it's concepts about realities, and only when there is the understanding, right understanding intellectually, that there can be dhammanusati. Without a Buddha's teaching, no dhammanusati, no pariyatti. Can one also say that buddhanusati is also pariyatti, because it's also only when there is some understanding of the Buddha's virtues or the Buddha's teachings that there can be reflection on the Buddha, there can be buddhanusati, so it is
pariyatti. Yeah, but it's not long story. about the Buddha's virtue at moment of understanding whatever appears now. It can be buddhanusati.
Buddhanusati, yeah. So it is pariyati, yeah.
And so without any understanding
of reality or reality as not self, it really cannot be buddhanusati at all.
So there's no instance of buddhanusati with the concept as object of citta.
This concept as object buddhanusati.
I mean pariyati, but what I mean is that concept of...
It's always concept of realities.
But not concept of reality. Is there no instance of Buddha Anusati when it's not a concept of reality?
What else is it?
I don't know. I'm wondering.
You mean concept of the...
figure of the Buddha?
No.
Because we know that without understanding...
Because we know...
Dharma, yeah. It cannot be Buddha Anusati. So.
Right. Let's say metta. The metta of Buddha is not the same as our metta. So we need to imagine.
But without any understanding about what metta is as a
but
dharma,
also,
as,
but also
then
there is a difference.
There cannot be any reflection on metta.
Yeah, so at that moment there's reflection on the metta, but also we're thinking about degrees of metta that's not there. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about Buddha who has more pandya, more metta, more everything. Otherwise, it's just, we can even talk about devas having kusla. So what's the difference?
So now is there any understanding of the Buddha's metta, the great metta?
Not the extent. Nobody would ever have the level of metta. So he would have to rely on the fact that his own imagination that it would be much greater than what he knows or experiences.
So the understanding of those qualities or of the teaching as given by the Buddha would depend on the degree of understanding about the realities, including the metta that there is. For example, if there's no understanding about what metta is, or no understanding about different realities, or no understanding of dharmas as anatta, then there cannot be any understanding.
Sure. No idea.
Of,
no idea.
There cannot be any.
No understanding about reality means
virtues.
Not understanding the Buddha.
No.
But I'm wondering whether
So the degree to which there is wise reflection on the why there is buddhanusati will depend on the degree of understanding that's been developed. So for us, that reflection is nothing compared to the reflection of a sotapanna.
Okay.
One example to consider, one of the attributes of the Buddha, Loka Vidu, seer of the worlds. If there's just an idea of what that means, based on no real understanding, then it's not reflection on the quality of the Buddha.
No, I get it now. Sarah just mentioned that for Sotapanna it would be another level, for us it's going to be another level. So it's each, we'll have as so much Buddha Anusati as our level of understanding.
Even just that word, seeing now, arises and falls away. Can that be conditioned for being grateful to the Buddha's words and his virtue, and that is Buddha Anusati, by conditions? No matter what word bring about the understanding of reality right now, that can be conditioned for thinking about the Buddha's virtues and his karuna, great karuna, compassion.
Correct. So there is Buddha Anusati with thinking
with
about
understanding, at moment of understanding. It bring about thinking about.
Because at the moment of understanding the value of the teachings, and then referring to the teacher, one is understanding one thing, the other is at that moment, it's not understanding a reality. But
for example,
making the link between.
Yes, but for example, hearing about seeing that it's conditioned, so it arises and falls away. That can be conditioned for thinking about the great compassion of the Buddha, for his teachings, 45 years, for anyone to come to hear the right words.
And one would have to know the value of compassion to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And that is puttanusati. It doesn't mean that we have to think a lot.
In the book on parami, on perfections, there's one part where we read the commentaries about the story of the King Pukusati, the friend of Bimbisara. And when he was reading the letters by his friends about the Dharma, then we read that he attained the four jhanas, right? So at the moment, was that Dhammanusati? Or?
At the moment of thinking about the virtues of the Buddha.
The virtues of the Buddha?
How but great compassion. Otherwise, no one hears about these words, about realities right now.
But I remember, if I'm not mistaken, that for unenlightened people, we cannot have the Buddha's nusati to the point of jhana, only to access concentration, right? But
so it depends on conditions too. For us, without the jhana, we can have such moment of thinking with joy or whatever, mm-hmm. about hearing the teachings. But from that on, it depends on conditions, what level of citta is there, as jhana or not. But I think that puttanusati and the other dhammanusati and so on cannot bring about the jhanas, no matter who.
But at that period of time,
only
it was
upacara
before.
Samadhi okay. can be attained.
Because it takes a certain amount of discursive thinking and reflection, so it cannot be jhana level, only upacara level.
But I think it's mentioned there that he attained the jhana, so that's why I'm a little bit. I think it was Dhammanusati or Buddhanusati, because he was reading the. No. It just said jhana.
So
okay.
So there can be many moments of Dhammanusati, Buddhanusati, but then at that moment he attained jhana, but
maybe
must
another,
be another object.
Okay.
And only the Aryan Sotapanna can attain upacara.
If one has mastery of jhana with a certain object, it can be attained at any time. For example, with that.
In answer to the earlier question also about attachment and aversion, or even like this, we know anything can be decisive support condition for anything else. So reflecting on the Dhamma may be condition at that moment for jhana to arise with another object or condition so complicated. Like when Sariputta was fanning the Buddha and attained jhanas at that moment, so the object is not, he's listening to the Dharma, but it's not Dharma. What we don't know what that object, it could be breath, it could be anything at that moment.
So, can I ask a technical question about jhavana? Bhavanga citta. The sense was three bhavanga cittas take place, atita and charana and upacheda, yeah? But my question is, how about the mind, or how many prior to mano dvara avachana citta, yeah? How many?
Two.
Just two.
Yes, Pavanka Chalana and the Pavanka Upacheda.
My question is, why two?
Because the object is not that which is that which impinge or contact. Because you see that when we talk about the 17 moments, we just talk about the, what you call the period of rupa, that it arises and falls away at what moment of citta. Even it's not that, no matter what citta are there, 17 moments of citta is the age or the period of one citta.
Okay, so the mind was just two. Okay. Next, about the sense door, and the end of sense door, tadarambana citta may take place, yeah? Could be 2 moments, yeah? And it's vipaka citta, yeah? And I think I've heard in one of your old tapes saying that it can take place through the mind door.
Who knows? It can, possible, but who knows?
But we are talking about the sense door. Why tadarambana take place at the mind door?
Because it follows immediately, and the other rupa arises immediately.
There's no mind door process in between.
After the sense door?
No. So at the end of a sense door, at the end of sense door process.
And the mind door process which immediately follows.
Yeah, but before, prior to the occurrence of bhavangacitta and then following mind door, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
At the initial sense door, at the end of initial sense door, there would be there could be 2 tadarambana, and I may misheard of you, but probably I heard that you are saying that that can take place even at the sense door, even at the sense door.
It depends on karma, whether it can produce it or not.
At the end of the sense door or the mind door that follows that one, that sense door process.
And then my next question is that tadarambana, it's a vipaka citta, yeah? Is it the same sort of, does it have the same cause same cause for three earlier vipaka citta, that is what? For instance, chakvijñāna and
same karma.
Can one say, for example, in an idle process that each vipaka citta in that idle process, the seeing, the sampaticcana, the santirana, and the tadarambana
conditioned
by same karma?
Next third question is related with what I wanted to know yesterday. That is memory, is sanya. We have acquired lots of memories. Oh, okay. And in terms of Abhidhamma, it must be stored somewhere, yeah?
Sanya arises with each citta. No one can change that. So there can be the moment of remembering the moment that you think that there is no sanya. But actually it's that kind of sanya which does not appear as sanya of this or that.
But outside sort of Abhidhamma, there are lots of sciences and medicine and psychology, and they specify a specific location, yeah, as a storage of memory. Yeah? And in Abhidhamma doesn't assume any place to store, physical place to store memory. Yeah? For instance, Hadayavati cannot become a place to store memory. Yeah?
And memory, for example, when I studied psychology, the memory that's studied in science or psychology is completely different from sanya.
Yeah, it's completely different from sanya.
Yeah. So the sanya we're talking about arising at each moment, and as we discussed yesterday, how it accumulates at each moment of
kusala or akusala, and never lost, even when someone has very bad memory or has dementia, there's still sanya at each moment marking the object. Nothing is lost, nothing is forgotten, and it is carried with each citta, so nothing is lost.
So it's carried by each citta, but to be more specific, it's carried by sanya. Can we say that?
By each citta.
Each citta or each sanya?
The tendency, all the latent tendencies, all the tendencies wholesome and...
These anusaya, they are different. We are talking about...
We're talking about...
Memories. Yeah. These are later.
It is a tendency and asya.
Asya and Upanisa, they are a bit different from actual so-called memory. They are accumulated tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm talking about...
Remember both anamas.
Yeah.
Anything, we talk, memory is also nama.
Yeah.
Aversion is also nama.
Yeah.
So aversion accumulate, memory also accumulate, but as namas.
No, memory, no. When we say tendency to perform akusala or akusala, then it's anusaya.
What about the marking or remembering white color, that tendency to remember that moment?
Basically, sanya has two functions. One is to...
Never lost. It's accumulated with the citta, that marking of white color, that remembering of white color, so that later we go out and there is the remembering of white color.
To my understanding, sanya, which takes place at the sense door, has a function of marking.
Mm-hmm.
Sanya, which takes place at the mind door, which are the function of so-called memory, means the remembering or recall.
It's also marking. It's marking all the time.
Just that. Only that. That's why it is sanyakhanda, not sankarakhanda.
Sanya has only one function, marking function. That's it.
Remembering.
No, then how about simile, famous simile of a carpenter marking, then after...
Just marks.
No. After marking, then he would able to build a house or a lodge based on that marking. Yeah? But when he actually creates something, also he has to rely on his notion of sort of memory.
Well, marking, once you mark a log, it's...
No, if you mark, just if you keep marking, you cannot remember anything. How can you remember?
When you mark, it's remembered, as Zita is saying.
Marking is marking. Marking is different from remembering.
Not remembering, I'm saying remembered. Once it's marked, and next time you come to it, it's already marked.
I think what it says about that simile is that it's marked so that he can
find it again. So he goes around marking all different logs, and then he's able to find them again afterwards. But we don't know about the remembering, whether it's a single moment or whether it's a multi-moment processes, but still sanya is involved, that's all. So we don't have to think about it because it does happen and involves sanya.
Yeah, it involves sanya, but I cannot imagine that. Sanya has only a singular function, which is marking. If you keep marking, how can you remember what you've done, say, yesterday?
Remembering seems to involve sanya, which marked in the first place.
Yeah. Which chetasekas perform the function of remembering we had such and such conversations yesterday. Is it?
It'd be chitta. Chitta accompanied by sanya.
Yeah, it's not precise.
It have to be. Why do we want to be more
until
precise?
Until sanya appear as objects of understanding. And even so, it's only that which is the self, it's just reality. So why do we learn about sanya and everything as not self in order really to understand the characteristic when it appears, so that there can be the letting go, the idea of self? That's all. Just for that.
Naively thinking, for instance, when Buddha, before his enlightenment, Buddha, you recall all the details of his previous lives, it's done by sanya. If sanya has just a function marking, how can you remember all of these details?
By sanya.
No, sanya is marking.
Well, it's marking. I'm not sure, but it's marking so that you can think about it again, and it's marking so that you can think about what's marked.
I think John has a good
The same person who marked the log can remember where it is afterwards.
Yeah.
So,
Tadal's
question is that remembering is what? Is it still sanya or
Jonathan,
something else?
Jonathan, you just keep marking. You keep marking.
Yes.
How can you remember where you marked?
No, but
you have to have function. Remembering your marking.
Sorry, he recognizes the mark later. That's my mark. I've marked that.
Yeah,
that's my mark.
It's different from actual marking.
Yes. So,
no, you just marking. If you say it's a function, sanya, then you require some kind of chetasika, which you remember how these things are marked. It's different from actual marking.
Cannot say. Kunsantra, do you remember the two words?
Sorry?
The characteristic of reality.
Characteristic of
hardness of fire or tejo. There are two functions, or what you call accomplished, like it's hard but it can burn.
Yes.
See, the same characteristic, heat. When we talk about just heat and then we talk about that which burns, it's like sanya.
The manifestation.
The accomplishment of that reality.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
I could remember the Pali term.
No, I can't. I guess just listening to Tadao there, I was thinking that this is slightly different, but at the moment, like, Vipaka Chitta with Chaitanya, it can have the function of Sahajatapachya. Whereas in the moment of Jhāvana, when Chaitanya arises, it's got Nānākāṇika. So I thought maybe there is two aspects for sanya. Is there? With just that one you've just mentioned.
Yes, but I forgot the Pali word for it.
I'll look it up and we can speak about it later. Because, like, just going back, at the moment of Vipaka Chitta, Chaitanya is called Sahajatapachya. That's Vipaka, it's not Kamma, in the sense of, it's Vipaka Chitta. But at the moment that that Chaitanya arises in the Jhāvana process, that's a different type of Chaitanya. That's the type of Chaitanya that can produce results later on. Obviously, at the moment of arising in Vipaka Chitta, that won't produce late results later on. It's produced a result. But Chaitanya that arises in the Jhāvana process is called Nānākāṇika Sahajatapachya. So it means that it will produce a result at a later time.
Only when that result is produced.
Sorry?
It's only when and if that result is produced that it's Nānākāṇika. Just because that Chaitanya is capable of producing result, for example, at a moment of killing, doesn't make it Nānākāṇika. Only when there is the result later on.
Yes, that's what it means. It means it's capable of, at
that jhāvana process, that's a good point that Sarah has just mentioned, that it will produce a result at nāna, at another time. Nāna means other, and kandika means time. Possessed of other, it's, at that moment, it's possessed of other time, the potential to produce a result at another time.
But one cannot say that at that moment that it is nānaka, kānaka, pachya, until there is the result. Okay. It's just
sahajata. Because when we talk about pachya, we're talking about the pachya and the pachupana rasa. So it has to be...
Yes, sir. As far as I know, Chaitanya has sort of two functions. Yeah, it's similarly, it's a carpenter's head of the carpenter has his carpentry task, as well as he has to organize all his work co-workers. Yeah, remember that simile? Yeah. So it seems to have two functions. You are not talking about this two functions. It's different things. Now you are talking about.
Sarah's got a really good grasp on it, so please.
Actually, it always has the same function, which is to coordinate. It always has the same function
to coordinate the chaita seekers and the chitta that arise with it. But at those moments of kusala and akusala, it is capable of bringing a result later if other factors are in place. And only when the result arises later can one say that is by nāna, kānaka, kāma, pachya. But the function is always coordinating the citta and the citta seekers that arises together with. But we're just talking about two different conditions, sahajata, kāma, pachya, and nāna, kānaka, kāma, pachya.
Now I remember the Pali word, Kunsundra, sampatti rasa.
Sampatti.
Rasa. Rasa is gicca. Yes. Because when we talk about a characteristic like hardness, it's hard, but at the same time it holds or contains the other reality. So when we talk about heat, it's hot, but it can burn. So that is sampatti rasa, when it burns. Rasa. It's kicca. Another word for kicca is rasa.
Function.
Yes.
Function.
So when it is sampati rasa, it means when it completely or accomplished. So it remember when it has marked. When it has marked. So it remembers.
Just like on the blank paper, you write something. So before there was nothing, but when there is writing on it, it's the marking, and at the same time, the meaning is made known.
Okay. So can we say that Sanya's function is just one,
yes,
which is marking. However, it seems to have two sort of manifestations. One manifestation is actual marking. The other manifestation is sort of remembering. Can we say that?
If it cannot remember, can it mark?
Maybe.
The way around.
But the question here is, if it cannot remember, can it mark? A newborn baby is marking from the very moment.
No matter newborn or old one, sanya is sanya.
It's marking, and what is it remembering at that time?
Later, it remembers who's who.
Yeah, but at that time, when it's just born.
Because there are two rasa, two kinds of function. The function which marks and the function which remember.
It's still performing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that, the example of Chaitanya is also a good one. One can say that Chaitanya, as Sundara said, coordinates, and when it's kusala or akusala, one can refer to the function of intending wholesome or unwholesomeness at that moment. Would that be correct, Ajahn?
The function of Jetasikas depend on the chati of citta as well.
So when it's vipaka, when it's kusala, then that function is also determined.
It to coordinate in one sense.
In the coordinate and at that point to perform kusala.
And when it arises with kusala and akusala, it's different.
Okay, so we remember lots of things, and most of them are concepts, in the form of concepts, but at least we remember lots of things, And just before said that we remember because of citta, but can we say that we remember all these sort of memories as sort of carried, passed from one moment of citta to next moment of citta because of sanya? In other words, sanya pass all our memories from moment one moment to next moment?
In order to understand more about the difference between the five khandhas, vedana and sanya are not the sankhara khanda. So it just performs its function when it arises to feel vedana with pleasant or pleasant. And sanya just marks and remember. And the other jetasikas which arise with these perform the function of sankhara khanda.
Are you asking whether the accumulation of memory is the function of sanya itself or the something else? Is that your question? I'm thinking now about sanya arising with every citta. So vipaka has only seven chetasikas, but we know that the tendencies continue. So at that moment, the other chetasikas are not rising, but they are also being passed on. So at that there we can see that it's not, even though they're not arising, lopa, for example, is still passed on. So I think it's not the question of the chetasika doing the job. It's the citta as a whole. It's the citta of accumulation.
So it's clear now about khanda? Not yet. If nothing arises at all, can they?
Because when we think about khanda, then we think, in terms of Abhidhamma, we think that 28 rupas in rupa khanda, three or five vedanas in vedana khanda, sanya khanda, and 50 chetasikas, blah, blah, blah. So somehow we have a notion of this.
Because the rupa khanda cannot be any nama khanda at all.
So we have this notion of sort of group. It's like a basket, five baskets.
If you don't think much about group, just every one reality is there, rising and falling away.
So maybe today your baskets have just blown up and become many individual things.
Not many individuals, just one single reality.
Can you explain what sankhara, when we say sankhara khanda, what does the sankhara mean?
The 50 jetasikas.
Is that all that sankhara means? Because the word sankhara has many meanings, doesn't it?
Sankhara dhamma is conditioned realities. Sankhara dhamma.
Mm-hmm.
But vedana is sankhara dhamma. And it is vedana khanda. And sanya is sankhara dhamma, and it is sanya khanda. And the other 50 jetasikas are sankhara dhamma, and they are sankhara khanda.
And what do you mean by the function of sankhara khanda, as opposed, you said vedana and sanya don't perform the function of Sankarakanda. They're not Sankarakanda.
Any time when it arises, it fails. But the other jetasikas which arise with it condition the Sankarakanda for the next moment to be. Like panya, right understanding, it's not feeling, it's not sanya, it's not vedana. But the panya now condition the other moment of sanya later to be different.
Can you say that again, please?
Okay. Kunsukhin.
The other chetasikas influence others, whereas sanya just marks, the vedana just feels. So the panya that arises with visible object, for example, is a moment of anatta sanya that's being accumulated, right? It is because of the panya that the sanya is also different. So the dosa arises with sanya.
What do you mean sanya
is different? Anatta, not sanya. Right, or anger as an attachment, as against attachment. Anger towards a person and attachment to the person is different. So you can see that the anger is having one kind of influence, attachment is having another kind of influence.
But on the other hand, when we say that Vedana just feels and Sanya just marks or remembers, but actually we know that by Sahajatapachya that they all condition each other, that even not just the 50 Sankara Kanda Chetasikas, but even Sanya, Vedana, each conditions each other. And
by
each
way of Sahachata.
By way of Sahachata.
Together.
Together. All right. Okay.
Yeah, I don't understand. What's the point?
Well, the point was, I think Azita was trying to find out about the difference between Sanya, Vedana, Kandas, and Sankara Kanda.
Not the question I have.
For an explanation of what it meant when we say Sankara Kanda, what do we mean by the Sankara?
The 50 changes.
It's not what it means. You're not asking what they are. You're asking what it means for them to be Sankara. So Ajahn gave the answer that they influence the other chetasikas arising with it. For example, Lopa. They condition by way of Sankara, not just Sahajata or other kind of pache. But there's no such.
Are you saying, Ajahn, that because we know they all condition each other, but we're saying that those 50 chetasikas, but not Sanya and Vedana, they also conditioned by way of accumulation in a way that Sanya and Vedana don't?
Because you see that the function of Vedana is just to feel and Sanya is to remember, that's all. Mm. But the other jetasikas like Pasa and Jedana and Spanya, see, they perform the function of condition the next moment to be such and such.
I see. Conditioning the next moment. Can we not say, for example, when Sanya arises, let's say it's marking visible object now, that it doesn't condition the next moment also?
What about the other jetasikas arising?
They also influence it together.
But it can condition the next moment to be less or more attachment or aversion and so on.
But can we not say that the sanya conditions the next moment to mark similar object or
by Pakto Kamisya Pakche, only to mark.
But not condition or influence the...
Yeah, not condition the loba to be a certain way or something.
Otherwise, there would not be Vedana Khanda and Samyak Khanda. There must be only Sankara Khanda.